to the Parentpreneur Accelerator podcast, helping you build the business of your dreams while having time with the family you love. Here is your host, Cyril, the entrepreneur and proud dad, Alexis.
Thank you very much for your help, Ethan.
Hi there, it's Alexis here, and in this week's episode, I'm interviewing Alison Edgar. Alison is the Managing Director of Sales Coaching Solutions, also known as the Entrepreneur's Godmother. She's one of the UK's top 10 business advisors and is number one when it comes to sales and marketing. Alison's regularly featured on BBC One Breakfast, The Sunday Times, The Telegraph, The Guardian, as well as BBC Radio 4 Moneybox, and has recently appeared on LBC Radio. She's trained thousands of people nationally and internationally, and her client list ranges from startups all the way through to multinational conglomerates and includes Dragon's Den and Apprentice winners. Alison is a newly published author with her book Secrets of Successful Sales, in which she explains her four pillars of sales. And as a result of the fantastic content in that book, she has reached number one on the Amazon bestsellers chart. In this episode, we're going to talk about the secrets of successful sales and how she came to write her book and the journey that she went on with that. We'll also talk about her advice around sales, entrepreneurship, intrapreneurship, and communications, and the benefits of working with a coach or business advisor, and particularly one in the area of sales. Alison, thanks so much for joining me.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me, Alexis.
Fantastic. Well, let's start off with a bit about your journey, because in the introduction, I kind of explained a bit about what you do now. How did you get into this area and become sort of expert in the area of sales particularly?
So my background originally was hospitality management. So I worked in Sydney and I worked in Cape Town and I worked all over the world. And I've got a genuine love for people and customer service. So when I came back from traveling, I'd been away for 6 years, I met my husband, who's a software developer. So he had a bit of a normal job and I was still working shifts. So it was either I was going to get chucked or I'd have to find a normal job. So what I did was I got a job in sales and I worked for a big multinational company at the time and did my sales training there. I then went into working in another corporate sales organisation. So between working in sales for 20 odd years in hospitality, I was in and around small businesses all the time. And what I found really positive and really negative, that they were full of enthusiasm, but when the phone didn't ring, so when their marketing didn't work, they didn't know how to proactively sell. I would go and see clients every year and some of them had gone out of business and I thought, well, hang on, I can do something to help them because I can teach them to proactively sell. And that's when I set up the business originally, and that was in 2011. So at that stage, I was still working part-time in my job, had set up the business. I had two small children and disabled parents. So looking back at it now, I don't know how I coped with it all. It was a lot that was going on, really. It was tough.
Yeah, that's amazing. And so when you were juggling all of that, what were you doing at that point? Where had you got to and what happened next?
So I think this is an interesting point for the listeners, because I think a lot of people will relate to this, because during that time, which again I call the whirlwind, that I still had a bit of an income coming in because I was doing a couple of days at work. I wanted to be able to still take my children to swimming lessons and the nativity, and you know, I wanted to have it all really. Mm-hmm. And at that stage, I didn't really know, I didn't have a major plan for the business, I didn't have much focus for the business, and there was times where I thought, I'm not going to do that business, and then I go, I won't. And again, I think at any startup stage, it's a very emotive time, because you think, well, I could just go back to work full time. And something that happened as a real catalyst to this, which again, I think that a lot of parentpreneurs will identify with, you need help and support from the people around you to make it work. And I can remember one day, and my husband is just divine, literally, he's the most patient man in the world. And one day I said to him, I took a bit of a stroll and I went, "You don't support me. You're not helping me with my business." And he said, "Alison, I'm not helping you because you're not really running a business. You're just playing at it." And again, those words, again, for listeners, they might think, "Oh, that's quite harsh." But actually, that was the kick up the backside that I needed. So it was a couple of years, you know, this, I'd been doing it all for a couple of years. And it was that kind of statement that made me think, you know what? I'm going to go limited. I'm going to go VAT registered and I'm going to go for this. And I never regret, well, I say I never regret, you know, yourself having a business. Some days are
Yeah,
better than others. But,
indeed.
you know, it was definitely the thing that I needed because it helped me to compartmentalize my life, really, and to focus on what I really, really wanted. And I thought, you know, I could say, "Oh, I tried that and it didn't work," but I hadn't given it my all. And it was only, you know, if I'd given it my all and it didn't work, well, that's life, isn't it? But it was really putting the focus behind it that helped me become a proper business person, I think.
That's fantastic, and I think that sense of playing at it or being sort of emotionally invested, I think is so important. I think so many people feel that sense of the change that's sometimes required. I guess on the flip side, one of the reasons that sometimes people play at doing a business rather than really jump into it is, of course, the kind of risk and what if I fail and so on. And of course, some of that is irrational and it's just literally just a fear of what if it doesn't work the way I want it to, which there's no way that you'll know unless you try it. But some of it is rational, i.e., what if I can't raise enough income and so on. How did you kind of cope with those obstacles to be able to make that shift from as you kind of described there, sort of playing at it to really going for it?
So again, I think, you know, as a parentpreneur and having family, again, some of your listeners will be single parent families, some of them will be two parent families, some of them will have
Absolutely.
grandparents to help support, some of them won't. And I think every case is an individual case. For me, Neil had a decent job, you know, so we didn't have to worry that the mortgage wouldn't be paid or there wouldn't be food on the table. But as you know, having worked in sales, I mean, I used to earn six figures a year in my job before I had the kids. So we were used to having a good, you know, disposable income. And going back to part time, and again, I think, you know, I took 9 months maternity leave with both my kids. So during that period, I wasn't getting paid at all and I didn't have a business. So I think, again, you know, as a two-parent family, people think it's a lot easier. And don't get me wrong, it is easier than it is as a single parent. But, you know, it doesn't matter what you earn, you build your lifestyle around it and you set the standards, don't you? So I think for me, it was just really just trying to get that balance in place. But there was loads of times that I felt like saying to Neil, "Right, I'm going to jack the job in and just go for the business full time." And he's like, "No, I don't mean no. It sounds like he was involved. It's not really like that." But then if it hadn't worked, there would have been no income. So the trigger point to leave work was when I was earning enough money from the business that was making up for what I was earning from work, that I think a lot of people give up too soon. And that's when their businesses fail, because if you don't sell, you don't have a business. And cash flow is really important. And you can have all the best ideas in the world, but if you're not having enough money coming in from your business to sustain your lifestyle, it's mentally going to challenge you to the max.
Absolutely. And so in terms of those achieving those early sales, because I think certainly I identify with that when I started one of my businesses when I sort of came out of the consulting and corporate world, it's a big deal to suddenly make up for the money that you're earning, right? Because when I started my early businesses when I was like 13, 14, 15, the amount of money I had to raise to be more than what I was earning on my £3 paper round was not very much. Whereas of course when you have to do it later, it's a lot more. And how have you found that that's worked for yourself, but also for the other entrepreneurs that you've worked with to make the early days of the business successful? Because of course you know, it's often said that 90% of businesses fail. In fact, I was listening to Shoe Dog, the Nike autobiography, where he talks about sort of 26 out of 27 businesses fail. So how have you found is the best way to avoid going down the failure route and instead creating a business that actually you do get paid out of?
You know, I'm going to be really biased on this one, Alexis.
I've leveled it up appropriately so that you can be.
It sales, literally. So part of the reason that I know, and you know, I've had the business now, started in 2011, went limited in 2014. And I'm not saying that, you know, the business still isn't at the point that it could fail, because as a, you know, the face of the business, I'm at a high risk if anything happened to me through ill health or anything like that. So there is still the risk of failure in any business, at all. But the theme that I see, not just through me, but through, I've worked with some absolutely cracking entrepreneurs. So, I mean, I'd say one of the ones that your listeners may know is Jordan Dakin, who created the Grippit Fixing when he was 13. And he was the youngest contestant to ever get funding on Dragon's Den. And he's one of Deborah Meaden's investments. So I've been working with Jordan and the team at Grippit since Jordan was 19 and he's now 23. And, you know, you look at that type of entrepreneur, and again, he's taken investment. He crowdfunded £2 million twice. The first round oversubscribed in 5 days. I mean, it just went mad. And it was a really good business idea. But Jordan loves sales. So the reason that he worked with me early doors was he knew that the company had to focus on sales. And I think this is where, again, especially in the tech space, a lot of people are really, you know, the co-founders or the founders are techie, but they're not really business focused or sales focused. And all they think they need to do is pitch for investment. But if they don't eventually sell some of the products, or again, I know that there's the exit strategy that somebody big's going to buy them out, but you got to be able to sell. And I think that's a real thread that runs through the 10% is they really, really focus on sales.
Yeah, definitely agree. And as someone who has a tech business myself, I definitely identify with, in the early days, it's very easy to kind of get sucked into this idea that in my case, less so the investment, because we did bootstrap and we're funding it through essentially money that I was raising, that I was earning through consulting work. But certainly this feeling that, oh, because it's on the web, I don't need to sell. Like, because I'm selling it online, because people are, you know, the idea is that they just rock up, they read their features, they watch the little video that explains how it works, and they sign up and they buy it and they stay with us forever. And it's like, somehow there's that naivety that leads lots of people to go down that kind of route and think, well, you know, I don't need to sell. I don't like the idea of sales, and therefore that I'm going to do that. Whereas, of course, yeah, that's not the reality, right? It's in the example I've just given with my tech business, like, there are so many times we have to sell. In fact, you've worked with some businesses where they don't have a, if you like, traditional sales process. It's not like they have door-to-door selling or whatever. It does have online. Where does sales come in there? Because, as I say, there'll be some business owners or future business owners that kind of think, oh, well, the type of business I'm going into, it doesn't need the sales in the same way.
So I've got a little analogy because I get asked this quite a lot, and I try and make everything as relatable to people. So many people in different arenas make it so complicated. I try and make things as simple as I can. So I know this for a fact, because I'll speak at like even I was speaking at the business show in London a couple of months ago, and there would maybe be 300, 400 in the audience. And I get people to put up their hand if they know the difference between sales and marketing. And I tell you, it's only, I would say 5-8% of people know the difference between sales and marketing. And that's where the key lies. So again, it's a bit like golf. If you can imagine that marketing put the tee in the ground and put the ball in the tee. So they kind of set it up, your website, your videos, your social media, you know, that's all marketing. That's not sales. And then what happens is, as in sales, we take it down the fairway, put it in the green and put it in the hole, because only when the ball goes in the hole do you make any money. But sometimes you've got somebody in the audience from marketing and they go, that's not right. In marketing, what happens is we put the tee in the ground, put the ball in the tee, we put it right up to the pin, and you sales guys tap it in and take all the glory. So if your marketing is really good, it makes it easier for sales. But if you look at things like Amazon or eBay, that's not sales at all. That's just a hole-in-one for marketing. And that's where I think, again, a lot of people really want that holy grail that you just put it up and you put in, you know, people just put in their card details and they buy. But in a business-to-business arena, that's few and far between. It does happen, you know, like Amazon and eBay in a B2C market. Yeah, that's great. But in B2B, we call it the antelopes and the field mice. So, for example, which might help the listeners, we've got online courses. So we can sell one online course and somebody can go in there and just put in their card details. But they just, it happens once in a blue moon, like the hole in one for marketing. Whereas we will wholesale a batch of the online courses to business support agencies. But that's all done via sales. So I'll go and see them, or I'll have a call with them, or I'll negotiate. And that's where you make the bigger money in B2B. But, you know, and everybody dreams of this passive income that people just jump in there and buy it. But it just doesn't work like that.
Absolutely. And I think often looking for that, looking for the passive income, looking for the ability to do the Amazon or the eBay model, can result in missing some opportunities. I know with my own software business, we spent a long time with an assumption that says, yeah, you know, we can do all the marketing stuff, as you say, to tee the ball up next to the hole, and then probably do a bit of email support to knock it in and get the sale. And actually, when I was challenged by one of my own mentors, we'll talk about mentorship and coaching later, we tested doing different models and actually doing, you know, demonstration calls and essentially having sales scripts and train those people and having proper sales conversations. And suddenly, like 80% of my business growth came from doing that. So even if you're a business where you say, oh, well, actually, yeah, we do manage to have this marketing that works really well, there's often still capacity for the sales to work. And, Amazon is probably a good example where I'm sure there are still parts of Amazon that still have to go and do the sale. In fact, I know that they do because I've worked with some of their, as a consultant, some of their sort of major suppliers like Sony PlayStation and so on. You know, there's still a sales conversation to be had there to get the good deal so that they can be the ones that are part of that sales conversation. So, yeah, and I absolutely love that.
And that's where your antelopes come in, because you wouldn't get Sony PlayStation just by sending them an email. So, you know, that's where, again, looking at the field mice or the antelope, and the antelopes in business is where most of the money comes from.
Indeed, indeed. And so in your capacity as sort of coach, you've become known as, and your business is known as, the Entrepreneur's Godmother. Tell us more about that. How did that name come about, and what do you now do in that business?
So it came about really through need. You know, we talk about sales and you sell to needs. When I went incorporated in 2014, there used to be government funding. So say that I was working with your company, you would pay me a day rate, the government would refund you half the money back. So it was a really good time for me to really grow the business, because I was getting support from the government, really, you know, fundamentally. But they pulled all that support in 2015 and 2016. So it's just unfortunate. The people who need me most are the startups and the micro businesses. But the people who need me most are the people with least cash. So how do you help the people who need you most when they can't afford to pay you that much, and then you couldn't sustain your business? So that's when I created the online courses and workshops and to many models, so like the coaching packages, so that it's affordable. And I was going to call it, I've obviously called it Alison Edgar because that's my name, but I needed something a little bit more expressive. So I've got one of my clients who makes gin, and he's based in London, Butler's Gin. And he's the naughtiest boy that I've ever had to work with. He's so naughty. I love him, so naughty though. And I said, look, I need a name for this. And he said, Alison, it's really easy. You're the Entrepreneur's Godmother. And I'm like, I so am. So again, when I work with clients, they just feel like I'm their godmother. I work with quite a lot of young entrepreneurs, so and older entrepreneurs. You know, it doesn't matter how old you are, everybody needs a godmother. So the name just stuck really, and it's just been really well received. So, but I've just done a rebrand, so I still get sales coaching solutions. So that works with teams and bigger companies. Entrepreneur's Godmother is more of the, again, affordable model, and then more around, I'm writing my next book and I do a lot of speaking at events. So I've got three quite distinct brands for one person, to be honest. But we've got it, we've seemed to have nailed it now.
That's awesome. And see, you've obviously made that change and said, feel like you've nailed it. What impacts that had? Because a lot of businesses out there, they set their branding or they set their company name and all these sorts of things too early, and then aren't quite sure when to change it and what impact it can have. Sometimes it isn't the right thing to change, and it can just be rearranging deck chairs kind of exercise. But sometimes it can have a really big impact. What's been the impact in your case, and what do you think sort of has caused that?
Definitely the book, Secrets of Successful Sales, has really been an unexpected delight, really, I would call it. That the because I'm dyslexic, so the whole writing of the book was, I don't know, people, like, I speak to a lot of people and they go, oh, I'd love to write a book, I'd love to write a book. And I'm like, I never really wanted to write a book. The book kind of called me, and it's in keeping with the Entrepreneur's Godmother. How do you teach people who have got very little money? Well, you write a book, sell it for 15 quid, and they can access a lot of the information they need. So the book called me, and then the book just has gone mad. It sold out on launch day on Amazon. It sold out. We did a little video, and again, mark, not sales. The first day the first book arrived in the office, there's a 20-second video of me just going, we've got a book, we've got a book, we've got a book, we've got a book. And it went viral. It had something like 100,000 views and loads of comments. And then on the back of that, we had the, sign up now to get a copy of it when it launches on Amazon. So literally there was loads of people just signing up for the book, and it sold out. And from then, I mean, that's, and again, yeah, for anybody, any of the listeners who are thinking about writing a book, I would definitely recommend it. It was hard work for me again because of the dyslexia, but you've got to manage what you do with the book, because a lot of people can, you can get an Amazon number one bestseller at the drop of a hat, put it on at 99 pence or 99 cents, get all your mates to buy it, it goes to number one. But then day two, it goes to 1,000,001. For me, I didn't want just a number one bestseller. I wanted to write a classic sales book that people would use as a reference point. And touch wood, that's actually what's happened. So even today, it's number 13, I think, in its category. So it's never really been out the top 20 in its categories. It also went into WH Smith's business books as number 10. And I'm doing my WH Smith's book tour next week and the week after. So that's where the clarification of Alison Edgar, author, speaker, because what now happens is people want me as a thought leader in sales to speak at their events. So that's a revenue stream in itself. And then the other two just sit, but they've got completely, like, the Entrepreneur's Godmother is really pink because I can get away with that. I can wear a tiara, I can wear a wand. I can just, like, it's a really fun brand. And then Sales Coaching Solutions is a bit more sensible, so it's a bit less pink. And that is the, that doesn't always have to be delivered by me because the content is already pre-formulated. So longer term, and I have already gone down this path of other people deliver it and everybody wanted me, but I'm going to de-me from that brand and then move that forward. So it's all quite clear. And I think you have to pivot, you have to try it. We've tried things that haven't worked and we've pivoted around, but now I think the clarity in the brands are there.
No, that's amazing. I love that. And congratulations again on the tremendous success that you've had with your book. To delve into that a bit deeper, aside from just being a smart person with some awesome experiences and so on, what would you put, is there anything else that you'd put down the success of that book down to? Because as you say, it is possible with gimmicks and tricks to achieve number one overnight and then for exactly one night. And you haven't done that. You have gone into these bestseller lists, but you've also gone into things like, as you said, the top 10 for business at WH Smith. What would you put the success of that down to? How have you ended up with such a good book?
Do you know, that's a really good question because, and we talk, you know, going back to where we talked about earlier, I think imposter syndrome is something a lot of your listeners will really struggle with. Just not feeling that, you know, that you've got it or that other people have all got it going on. And I think comparing yourself to other people is just the biggest no-no. And I think having gone through that myself, so for me, there was a huge fear. I mean, I have no shame about talking about fear of things that I've done or didn't do. And I think the fear for me, first and foremost, was what happens if I write this book and nobody buys it? And the fear of that was, well, look, I've just wasted a year of my life, but hey-ho, I've got a book. I can always tell my grandkids I've written a book.
Yeah.
But the second biggest fear was the biggest one, I think. What happens if I write this book, people buy it and they think it's rubbish? And that was literally the biggest fear, because it sounds really bad, but everybody's an expert in something, right? This is, I do a lot of give back and I work with a lot of kids in schools, and the under achieving kids, they're my favourites because they feel that they've not got any purpose or direction. And for me, everybody has got a thing. Doesn't matter what the thing is, it could be singing, dancing, social media, gaming, don't care. You're good at something, you just have to find what you're good at and turn that into your talent or your drive or your purpose. So it was really worrying for me that I think, oh, I'm writing this stuff, but everybody knows this. Everybody knows these things, but you find actually not everybody does know these things. Not everybody, and especially sales, because most, it's not like something you can go to uni to learn or college to learn, that actually I do have a lot of information that people don't know. And I think one of the things people love, I kid you not, Alexis, I'll go to like events and there will be there's always somebody who will come up and they will bring me out of their handbag or out of their bag a copy of Secrets of Successful Sales. But it's got like shed loads of little marker things, you know, the little tiny post-it notes. Loads of highlighter pens. They literally use it as the sales Bible. They will go through it. And that shocked me, completely and utterly shocked me. The other thing that makes me really, really emotional, every other day, I'll get a message from somebody somewhere in the world that I've never met in my life, right? Never met them. And they'll tell me how much my book has changed their life, their world, their sales, their business. And again, I could never have dreamt that. It's just, I can't even put it into words, those feelings. So, I mean, I think copies-wise, we've sold about 3,000-ish since launch, which again, as an independent published book, that's a lot of books because usually the big ones come from Penguin or, you know, HarperCollins or whatever, and you get an initial order for like 10,000. But we've literally plugged away. I think the reason it's been so successful is I never stop marketing it. Every single day I'll find an angle or a twist to put something out on my LinkedIn with a link to the book. It had a really strong launch. So once it's got a strong launch, it's been packaged with Stephen Covey's 7 Habits. It's been packaged with the Chimp Paradox. So when people package it, they package it with those books, which gives it real credibility. So I never in a month of Sundays could have planned it, dreamed it, or hoped it, but it's just exceeding all expectations.
That's awesome. And I love that, to boil that down a bit, like, to some extent, your answer for how did you create such a good book comes from fear of writing a bad one. And that's a really interesting factor, because I think, you know, because you could have said, oh, well, you know, I spent a load of time researching books, or, you know, I read lots and I always felt like I could write a good one, or, you know, I got a mentor or whatever. And it's interesting that actually for you, like, that big motivator of, I don't want to do a bad job. I don't want people to go, oh, yeah, I bought your book. And you go, oh, good. How was it? And they go, rubbish. It's like,
I know. Oh.
Like that fear. But you know, I remember I gave a presentation at Mum's Enterprise Roadshow a few months ago about how actually fear can be good or useful. As long as you kind of use it in the right way, and that you use it not to stop you to do something, but instead to help you to, you know, mitigate a risk or to do something differently, as you have done in this case. And so that fear that drove you to do a good job, what did you then do differently? Did you literally just work harder on it? Did you spend more time editing, reviewing? Did you get more people involved? What did you do, or what did you believe was required so that you would do a good job of it?
So a couple of things. I, again, because of the dyslexia, it's hard for me to read. So reading is hard. So one of the things I didn't want to do, and again, there's two views of thoughts on this. There's people who just absorb information and then they regurgitate and make their version of other people's information theirs. I didn't want to do that. So I have never read a business book in my life. Everything I do comes from my heart, my experience and my gut, and speaking to, again, taking advice from people who are knowledgeable. So literally getting them to feed me in. Does that make sense? Whereas, you know, loads of people write books, but it's just regurgitations of the classic books. So I do quote, you know, I watched a video of Simon Sinek's Why, and I thought, well, actually, I do that anyway. I talk about that even before I watched the video. One of the things that really, really blew me apart was Carol Dweck's Fixed and Growth Mindset. And I didn't know anything about that until somebody mentioned something in our Facebook feed about fixed and growth mindset, and I watched a video of hers and I did a wee bit more research on Google. But again, I had never read a book on it. But that, it sounds really corny, but it's how I've lived my life and always have lived my life. So my version of the truth is my version of the truth rather than other people's versions of other people's truths. So I think that's what people love about me, that it's not regurgitated from anything else. The belief in how to get that out there is kind of what I teach. So it's kind of like, what would I teach other people to do? Somebody said to me, Alison, I'm writing a book and I really want to get it out there to as many people as I can, and I really want to get as much traction behind it as I can. What would I do? Literally what I've done for mine is what I teach. So I always, always, always stick by the rules. So I did get reviews. I mean, literally every time I meet somebody and they say I bought it, I'll go, please, can you do an Amazon review? Please, can you do an Amazon review? So, and, you know, it's got 85, I think, 5-star reviews on Amazon. And I've not written them, but I've always asked people, because that's what you would do in sales. You always ask for a referral. You would always ask for a testimonial. So it's the same methodology that I put into the book that I put into life. And why I was always a really top performer in sales was the methodology that's in the book. Do you know what I mean? So it all sort of seems to just feed in from how I live my life.
Absolutely love it. And I think I love the fact that it comes from that passion for teaching people to do, you know, to be successful, and how actually by you thinking about, rather than, oh, I'm going to write a book, and trying to think about what writing a book looks like, instead it's just finding a way of taking what you would teach someone and turning it into a book. And I think it's a subtle difference, but it makes such a huge impact to the quality and the usefulness of that book. Because rather than it trying to be a book for book's sake, which unfortunately some people fall into because they're really excited about writing a book, instead, you know, it's very much sounds like the book for you was just this vehicle of taking what you would teach otherwise.
Exactly. And, you know, this is the thing, that I did an author's speech, an event a couple of weeks ago, and I'm like, the book called me. I didn't call the book. I didn't want a book. The book literally called me. And what I did, it was really interesting, because when I set up teaching people to sell, I knew that I was really good. And it wasn't just me. So there was all these overperformers, but it was always the same people. So I had to really unpick everything I did to create the methodology, because I didn't have a methodology, because I'd never been a sales trainer or a sales coach. I'd just been really good at sales. So it took me a long time to come up with the methodology. But when I did, again, that's where literally I just took the methodology and put it in the book. Everything had to fit in one of the pillars. So the pillars are around behaviours, process, strategy and confidence. So actually when I put that in place, it was just a case of taking some of the stuff that I'd written, because I'd been writing quite a few blogs as I'd been going along, and slotting those into the book. So it did. And one of the things, it's not a massive book. It's 156 pages, I think. And I think that's one of the things that people love. They get to the end. It's not filled with academic jargon. It's quite, again, simplistic in its delivery style.
Yeah, I love it. And given the time that we've got, I'll go lightly into some of the sales tips and so on that you've got. But of course, highly recommend checking out the book, and we'll make sure that we've got links to it in the show notes. But just give us a little taste, perhaps for someone who's they know that sales is perhaps a weak area for them. Let's say that they've already resolved that they're going to buy the book and go deep and learn a load more. But perhaps they've got some big sales opportunities that are coming up. What immediate changes would you recommend someone make to try?
So I'll give you a couple. First, fundamentally, the biggest secret is when it's delivered correctly, sales and customer service is exactly the same thing. That's my mission statement. That's at the core of everything I teach. So, for example, for you with your software, Alexis, you know that what you do makes operations easier, or, you know, whatever the software actually does. Mm-hmm. So by you contacting somebody and finding out what the problem they've got in their organization, you're not actually selling them the software. You're just delivering them a great customer service to make that problem easier. So I think it's always keeping fundamentally that you know that what you do is going to make their life easier. So it's not a sale, it's a customer service. So from a mindset perspective, then that's a really positive thing and will help confidence, really. The other thing is around the behavior. So I'm a DISC practitioner. So it's really, really understanding the person that you are engaging with, because some people are task focused, other people are relationship, some people are introvert, other people are extrovert. And, you know, you're taught to treat other people the way that you want to be treated. I turn that on its head. Don't treat them the way you want to be treated. Treat them the way that they want to be treated. So that's another core learning. The other thing when it comes to sales, so many people get it wrong because they go, and I do this, and I do that, and I do the next thing. They do too much talking. Sales is not about talking. Sales is about listening. And that's, again, you know, one of the fundamental areas that I see going wrong. And then, the final pillar is confidence. And the reason people struggle with confidence, they don't know the behaviours, they don't know sales process, and they don't have a strategy. So they're fumbling around in the dark. So it's the other three pillars that give you confidence, really, to be able to achieve those sales.
That's awesome. I love that. I've been frantically tapping that down. And that's, I love those as really discreet tips, and completely agree with them. It's like when you mentioned the selling, selling the why of the product, essentially selling the what's the impact that you have. That's definitely something that I identify with. You know, with my software business, we for quite a while have had and have had success with selling it as a 360 feedback tool, because there are people out there, HR directors, etc., that do genuinely look for a 360 feedback tool. They're looking for the product, the solution. They're looking for the hammer. But actually, we've found that we can get better growth and more invested customers and employees and team, actually, around what is it that we do for people. And so in our case, that's, it's about development of employees, and it's about, achieving better performance, but also having them super engaged and loving what they do. And that becomes much more appealing to people that you talk to, rather than just, oh yes, I've got a hammer. Would you like to buy a hammer? It's a really good hammer, rather than what you do for people.
But then the further benefit into what your software does as well is that we know that per employee in the UK, and I'm making these figures up, it costs £5,000 to employ or recruit and train a new employee. Whereas if you can retain them by using a 360 tool, not only will they be more productive and help the company's productivity, but you'll actually be saving money in the long run because your recruitment fees will go down. So it's selling the benefits. And that's what people are interested in. You know, they're only interested in what you can do for them, not what the product actually does. And I think that's the common mistake that I see in a lot of startup businesses.
Absolutely. No, I think that's fantastic, fantastic advice. And so we've talked a bit about some top tips and the fact that your book is a great resource for going deeper into how to improve sales. Another way, of course, is through the support of a sales coach. Personally, I've had various mentors that have provided some aspect of sales coaching and so on, but never had a sales coach myself. What would you say are the particular benefits and you know, what kind of results have you seen for people that kind of get specific coaching on how to sell better?
It's really interesting because loads of people think they are sales coaches, but they're generalists, and it sounds really odd, but it would be like going to your GP and saying, can you take out my appendix? The GP can't do that. They're generalists. They know a wee bit of every part of the body. Whereas sales is a specific area. And it's one of the things that kind of annoys me. You've got like big franchise companies that think they know everything about every angle, but they can't go in deep. They don't know enough. Sales is a real specialism. And one of the reasons it really helps, and again, this is another thing, there's that whole thing of those who can do and those who can't teach. But as a sales trainer, I've got like my phone never rings, Alexis. Literally every penny that comes through my company is from me networking or engaging on LinkedIn, having Skypes. You know, I practice every day what I teach. And this is, you want somebody who can sell, not just talk about selling. And I think that's the difference. A lot of people have got the theory. One of the things when I do my coaching sessions, and again, I do coaching packages or I do like one-to-one sessions. But again, you know, one-to-one sessions are just a bit too hit and miss. You need something that's regular. You need to be accountable to someone, because especially if you don't like sales, you'll put it off and you'll do marketing, send emails. You won't pick up the phone. You won't see people. So I've got a really quirky head for sales. Don't ask me why. But some of the ideas that I come up with on angles in for my clients, and they've used it and literally, it's just transformed their business. I mean, that's why I do it. It just is such a magical, magical, you know, you look at Gripit, which we talked about earlier, that company's valued at £20 million now, you know, literally valuation 20 million. And that's not me. That's Jordan and the genius that is Jordan. But some of the things, I'll give you an example. He was over in the States at one of the massive, massive distribution companies for DIY in the States. And he sent me a text going, Alison, I'm sitting here and they won't sign. I can't get them to sign. And I text him back and I said, Jordan, you've just travelled thousands of miles to get that piece of paper with a piece of ink on it. Do not leave the office without it, and give him his due. Do you know what I mean? He sat there until they signed. So, you know, it's sometimes just having that person in the corner that really understands sales rather than just business. Because I never class myself as a business consultant. It's sales is my lane, and I know it. Not even marketing is my lane. It's just pure sales.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And that definitely speaks to me, because I think it's like we talked about earlier, like people have got their own different areas of focus and expertise. And, for example, in my case, mine wouldn't be sales. It's funny you say the phone doesn't ring for you. It's like, whereas most of my businesses, that's kind of the model, is, you know, setting it up so that the phone rings, and then the process of managing that. And a lot of my work or speciality has been around that kind of strategy piece and the model of the business. And that does not make me a good sales coach, you know, and I'd never sell myself as such. But I can definitely see the value of having that that specific niche expertise that allows you to really excel in those areas that count, of which sales has got to be one of the top ones. So yeah, absolutely love that. Unfortunately, we're running for time, and I could have spent at least another hour interviewing you, Alison. You've been a fantastic interviewee, and I appreciate you so much for your time today. Thank you so much. Before we sort of wrap up, I'm obviously going to, I'll make sure that we share some links to in the show notes to your book and also to your website, The Entrepreneur's Godmother. How else would you recommend that people learn more about you or reach out if they'd like to get your help or advice or tips?
I'm all over social. So on LinkedIn, it's Alison Edgar. Twitter, The Alison Edgar. Instagram, The Alison Edgar. I've also got a Facebook group, which has got over 2,000 members in there, called the Entrepreneurs Can Clan. So we engage, we put out some content on there, we do some threads on there. So I'm quite easy to find, Alexis. I don't keep my profile low. Or literally Google me. I've got about four pages on Google, so just you'll find me. I'm quite easy to find.
Fantastic. Awesome. Well, I'll make sure that we link to all of those on the show notes. But thank you again so much, Alison. I really, really appreciate your time. It has been awesome. And wish you best of luck and success for both your business and, of course, the amazing entrepreneurs that you will continue to work with in future.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode and have taken away some ideas that you can put into practice. You can find the links to any resources mentioned in this episode over on the show notes at parentpreneur.com/podcast. If you found this podcast useful, then please review it on iTunes. 5-star review ratings would absolutely make my day. Also, please join the conversation on this episode. Just head over to the Parentpreneur Accelerator community on Facebook, where you'll find other parentpreneurs that are sharing their experiences and helping each other to succeed. To find the group, just visit parentpreneur.com/community. Thanks very much.